found, you know, when I went to India, one of the biggest things that I find that was different there to the Western way of doing things was that there was no logic. There was no logic at all that I could find. And it was only then, and that's quite recently, that I discovered that we as Western people with Western educations and Western life experiences, we rely an awful lot on logic. And it doesn't always serve you well if you're trying to make decisions that really should be coming from your heart and not from your head.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Life Well Lived podcast with me, Shane Breslin. That voice you heard just now is this week's guest on the show, is Bibi Baskin, who is someone who will be familiar to a significant cohort of Irish people who will recall watching and listening to her shows on the Irish television screens during the 1980s and 1990s. Thereafter, she left for the UK and spent time with the BBC and ITV, but after just a few years there, she decided that the broadcasting life was no longer for her. She gave up her career, sold her house, and went for a three-week holiday to India. That three-week holiday turned into a 15-year stay, during which time she set up a heritage hotel and practiced a traditional Indian style of health and wellness known as Ayurveda. Bibi has returned to Ireland in recent years and now spends at least some of her time giving talks to groups about her experiences, particularly in the fields of health and wellness. In this episode of the show, we talk about her memories of growing up in a small town in the northwest of Ireland, her time in the public eye as one of the country's best known and best loved TV personalities, and why she decided to call time on that career and move to India. We also chat about the Ayurvedic way of life, why she decided to leave India after 15 years, about learning to love the rain and the art of doing nothing. Thank you once again for listening to the show. As always, the aim of the Life Well Lived podcast is to present conversations on navigating all the challenges that life routinely presents us with, becoming our best selves in the world, and ultimately living whatever it is that adds up to a life well lived, one of happiness and joy and fulfillment. All previous episodes of the Life Well Lived podcast are available on my website, shanebreslin.com, or on your favorite podcast player or app. Without further ado, on to this week's episode and my interview with Bibi Baskin.
So Bibi, it's fantastic to welcome you to the show. I'm really, really interested to speak to you because I've been familiar with Bibi Baskin from going back maybe 30 odd years when you were a familiar presence on our television screens. And we do share something in common, I think, because my father is from Ardrahan, County Donegal, and I know that you are from, or that you have a lot of connections to that part of the country too.
Yeah, absolutely, Shane. That's where I was born and grew up. Fancy that. It's only a little two-streeter town that you might know, obviously. Very small place, beautiful in its own way, but that's exactly the place that I grew up in.
Yes, and what are your memories of childhood, of growing up in Ireland? Like it's a small town. I know from spending summers there as a kid, it's a beautiful town, but I never lived there. So you grew up there. What are your memories, or what do you take from your childhood in a small town in West Donegal?
Well, I think for me anyway, memories of childhood are not so much about a sense of place, but more a sense of circumstance. And my circumstances were a bit unusual, I suppose, insofar as that sadly, my beloved father died very suddenly when I was six. He, remember it well, of course, he took me out for a walk after school. That would have been about 4 o'clock. And by 6 o'clock on that day, he was dead.
Wow.
A heart attack. And that really shaped me in enormous ways because those were the formative years of my life. So that was a big event, obviously. Nothing to do with the place, you see. And the other thing that was, I think, quite unusual, which is that I never had a classmate when I was at national school. And that's because I grew up as a member of the Church of Ireland, and we were very small indeed in number. And in the national school, there were only on average 12 kids. So you have 8 different classes at national level and 12 kids. So I never had a classmate. So those are my really strong memories about growing up, not connected with place at all, you see.
And so that strikes me as a very, very unusual or certainly uncommon circumstance. When I think when a lot of people will reflect or recall on their time in primary school, national school, secondary school, whatever their education background was, one of the things that they would remember most, I guess, is their classmates and friends. Did it feel unusual at the time or not?
No, not at all. Because you see, that was my norm. I didn't know any different. So I could find no fault with it. I thought this is just the way life is, if I thought at all about it, which is unlikely in those early years. But no, it didn't feel different, and I didn't feel any different because I knew nothing else.
Interesting. And what were your movements after that? Did you leave Ardra Donegal at a young age, or like what was calling you when you were figuring out what to do with your life or what you would like to do? What was calling you?
Nothing. I don't think anything has ever called me in advance. To this day, I don't do planning, and I think that's because of my father's death. That as I grew a bit older, I just came to the realization that you can make all the plans you want, but what if the person dies? What are you going to do then? So I had no calling ever, no plans at all. But I was very glad to get away to boarding school, because I think looking back at it now, quintessentially, I suppose it was a very much an alone childhood, not to be confused with loneliness, but an alone childhood. And I was very happy when I went to boarding school in Dublin. And I was very fond of playing piano. And I used to play night, noon and morning. And again, you see, that's a solitary practice. So even to this day, I say I'm pretty damn good at being alone.
Do you think that that's something that a lot of us are not good at?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are very interdependent and dependent. And my goodness, in India, where I lived for such a long time, that kind of dependence is actually cultivated. You know, here, for example, kids in their teens, you know, once you hit 17 or 18, parents will encourage them to go out on their own, get a flat, share a flat or whatever you do. Whereas in India, people are taught to be interdependent. And there's something to be said for both. But in my case, I'm afraid, yeah, alone is no problem. It doesn't mean I'm unsociable, I hope. You know, I can laugh and be an idiot like anybody else. It's just that I'm not afraid of being alone. And sometimes I quite like it.
Indeed. And did you, so there's obviously a very, very big difference between being alone and being lonely. Did you ever experience loneliness at any stage?
No, never.
You said that nothing called you, or you still don't plan. How did you, what were the steps that were taken? I'm a firm believer that we're products of our environment and that the opportunities that come up that we say yes to or say no to, and all of the things around us. How did you go from a small town in West Donegal to being a very familiar face and voice on the national broadcaster for not that many years down the line? What were the map out the steps for me there?
Well, it was a gradual process rather than the big plan, naturally. First of all, after I graduated, I spent 8 years in Trinity College. My postgrad was in comparative Indo-European mythology. Don't ask me, Shane. I don't remember almost. But like a lot of people, I also did a teaching qualification. And as George Bernard Shaw said, which is awful, about people once they graduate, those who can do and those who can't teach. And in a sense, that was me. I hadn't a clue what to do. Nothing was calling out, as you put it. So I became a teacher. But very soon afterwards, maybe a year or year and a half, maybe, or two, I realized, I suppose it was my first life lesson in the workplace, I realized that repetition is not for me. It's just too damn boring. And when it comes to teaching, although it's a noble profession and a good one, the fact is that this year you have, say, Mary and John and Susan in the class, and you're dealing with the difficulties they have in this subject. And then next year, it's Patrick and Trevor and Sean or somebody else, different faces, but the same problems in the same areas. And I thought, no, I can't do that for 40 years. So I quit. And then what do you do next? Well, I did come to realize that the thing that I love in life, and to this day I still love it, is learning. So I wanted to choose a job where I'd be learning something nearly every day. And that's how I started to take an interest in journalism. And writing feature articles eventually led me to a job in television. In a nutshell, that was it.
And when you reflect back on that time and that those steps that you say that weren't planned, and you're just doing one thing after the next and after the next, and was curiosity a big driver for you?
Yes, because I think curiosity is some kind of quintessential part of this lovely need to learn and wish to learn. You're curious about how does that work, or how what is she thinking about now? What is he thinking? So I was always a great reader, still am to this day, and love learning new things. And I think, yeah, curiosity is in there for sure. And I thought that if I became a journalist, now, not your hardcore political type person, feature writing, gentle, writing about education, about small industries, about somebody who's doing something interesting with their lives. There is a curiosity there, and you invariably learn something new, because one day you could be interviewing somebody about astrophysics, and you'd have to learn a bit about that. And the next day you could be interviewing somebody about how to make a good apple tart, and you might have the need to learn that as well. Mm. So yeah, curiosity, you're spot on there.
Looking at it from the outside, it looks like you would have to have almost bulletproof self-confidence to make the strides that you made in what was probably, I think, fair to say, a male-dominated industry in terms of TV and broadcasting back in the 1980s, 1990s. Did you have that bulletproof self-confidence? Was that something you had to work on?
Oh, God, no. I never even thought about it.
Really?
I mean, yeah, absolutely. I suppose I was quite naive. But, you know, like any young person, what age was I then? I never bother keeping track of times past. I prefer to live in the now, in this moment. But I would have been, say, in my late 20s, 30s. And like so many people at that age, all you're trying to do is have a job that'll pay the mortgage and pay the ESB bill, as it used to be called. And you might have a few quid extra over to go off to the Canaries for a week or two in the summer.
Yeah.
And that was really the height of it. So I didn't have any grandiose thoughts about, can I do the job, or am I self-confident? No, it was just about getting out there and doing a bit of graft and living a life.
If we reflect finally on your time in RTE, like you spent several years in RTE, you spent several years in London, I think, with BBC, ITV. Does it feel like a very different you? Do you feel like a different person now than you did back then?
Well, you know, I think that in many situations in life, we have a kind of a private confrontation with self. One thing that most people would tell you about is the sound of their own voice to themselves. I often talk about voice because I have a fascination with it. And people will say to me, but that doesn't sound like me. And I say, don't worry, I don't sound like me either. And as for appearance, sometimes, you know, RTE archives will dig me out and dust me down. And I'll be sitting here at home maybe and have the television on, and somehow I hear this voice and I think, oh my God, that's me. And then I look at myself and I think, I never looked like that. That can't be me. So I think that it applies to everybody, that sometimes you just don't feel like that was the real me, because it's not the me of today. Because we're always progressing, we're always learning new things, and therefore we become, in a sense, a little bit of a different person over the years. And God knows, I've racked up a few years at this stage.
I suppose it is quite an unusual situation too, that your work and your past is in the archives and can be dusted down. And I think a lot of us escape that eventuality.
You too. And you know, I don't have one record of myself in this house or anywhere in the world. I was interviewed just a couple of days ago for a radio station. And the person who was interviewing me had done all this research, and apparently she dug out all these BB shows and watched them. And I think she was quite astounded when I said, I don't know how to do that and I don't have any record of it. And I also don't mind. Because you see, Shane, I think it's not about the past. And for people who are too nostalgic, for people who keep looking to the future, the fact is that they're missing what's happening just now and we'll never get it back.
Yes, very interesting and very powerful, because it's and it's something that I, in my journey, I've reflected on a lot, because when I was really struggling, it was a case of I was living my whole life in a past that I couldn't change, and multiple futures that I had no way of controlling, and I didn't take the time to be present. And I still struggle with it, and I think a lot of people still struggle with it, but certainly I'm probably in a better position now than I have been in the past. But I'm sorry to hear that.
But I think it's something that's really worth working at. Because there's so much goodness, you know, everybody's problems, and some have greater problems than the rest of us. But if you look hard, there are good things happening at this moment in everybody's life. And I think you owe it to yourself. And so your listeners the same. We all owe it to ourselves to be happy. If we can't be happy, let's at least be content. So I would say dig around the present moment, and for sure you'll find some good things. And there's a lovely little exercise you can do when you're struggling there. Just when you get up in the morning, and as Deepak Chopra, a great Indian writer, taught me years ago just through his books, when we wake up in the morning, we have a choice of two movies that we can put on in our heads. The one can be, oh, this is awful, this is pure shit, I don't like today, my life's going wrong. Or it can be, you know what, this isn't bad at all. And I like to put on that movie. And the little exercise you can do if you're struggling is just get up in the morning and write down three things, only three. There's something almost magical, I think, about the number three, and I don't quite know why. Write down three things that you can be grateful for. And once you do that, you'll think, you know what? Life's not half bad. So there's a little trick.
Yes. No, gratitude is certainly... I remember when I started reading and started first paying attention to people talking about the importance of gratitude in our own mental well-being at the present time. I remember thinking of it, that it cannot be that easy. That does not make sense. It almost felt a little bit kind of bohemian or woo-woo or otherworldly to be thinking that I can do stuff like that. But certainly over a period of time, because it's not, if the first day you do that, you're going to feel stupid.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe the second time and the third time, it's going to feel like, what am I doing here writing down three things I'm grateful for? But over a period of time, when that becomes habitual, what I've discovered is that I start seeing those things that I'm grateful for every minute of every day, not just in the morning when I write down the three things. So it is very, very powerful. And it is a starting point that everyone can do, I think, right now.
It is. And, you know, that's also a very interesting point you raised there, that you might feel stupid and silly the first time you do it. At the moment, I'm giving classes in mindfulness and meditation, just at quite a basic level. And I always say at the start of the class, don't feel an idiot if you start to meditate. It's not a thing anymore that we used to think in the Western world was something done by hippies. And I also say, you don't also have to live in a hut up on the side of the mountains of the Himalayas and wear a loincloth in order to meditate. You can do it at a much more basic level. So don't feel like an idiot. That's very important. And then, you know, we all get used to it. We are creatures of habit, I think, fundamentally. And it doesn't seem strange at all.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. The habit thing is something I'm exploring a lot, because I think that it's very, very hard to make choices, I think. But I think that if we can make choices just for long enough to make a habit, I think then the habit takes over and we start doing things without, that become second nature to us, I think.
But do you trust your gut, Shane, when you make a choice?
Oh, we could talk about that all day. So, like, I've learned to trust my gut a lot more than I did in the past, and I've learned from experience and learned from mistakes where my gut was screaming at me, "Don't do this thing! Don't do this thing! You do!" And I put it down to, at that time, I put it down to fear, and I was afraid of doing it. But in hindsight, it definitely was different than fear. I know what fear feels like. And I know what gut instinct feels like. And they are slightly different.
Different, I would argue. Different.
They're different physiologically. When we actually pay attention to what it feels like in our bodies, that it is different too, yeah. And I think our gut and our intuition is hugely trustworthy. And I don't know where that comes from. Like, I don't remember a time where my gut instinct let me down.
No, I don't think it ever does. But we kind of shroud it with other things. Like you mentioned, fear. That could be an intervening factor. And I think that the opposite to trusting your gut instinct is to go with logic. And, you know, logic serves us well. 2 + 2 = 4. And there's no denying it mathematically. But it doesn't always work in life, because some decisions, I think, have to be made from the heart, not from the head. And I found, you know, when I went to India, one of the biggest things that I find that was different there to the Western way of doing things was that there was no logic. There was no logic at all that I could find. And it was only then, and that's quite recently, that I discovered that we as Western people with Western educations and Western life experiences, we rely an awful lot on logic. And it doesn't always serve you well if you're trying to make decisions that really should be coming from your heart and not from your head.
That's fascinating. And it is, yeah, it really is. You mentioned the difference, how your gut instinct feels different from fear. How would you describe that?
Well, when I give these talks that are mostly motivational talks and talks about how to bring change into your life, good change, not sad change, and I tend to illustrate that by talking about my own life and how I did that. And one of the things that I try to explain in that talk is that there is a huge connection between the mind and the body in terms of the mind actually causing you physical harm at times. And I just give one simple example. I say to the audience, when you get nervous, do you feel butterflies in your tummy? And they'll say, yes. And I say, well, that's the influence of the mind on the body. So you do feel it in different parts of you. That would be one example. But I think it's most definitely there. And I always veer towards listening to that inner voice, the thing that we've been calling the gut instinct. Other people, maybe if you were a Hindu, practicing Hindu, they might call it the third eye. In Christianity, it might be called the Holy Spirit at work in your life. Look, you can call it any damn thing as far as I'm concerned. I just know that we all have an instinct and we should be listening to that rather than too much of this other practice of intellect. The heart is where it's at, in my view.
I agree. Well, I agree wholeheartedly. And it's come full circle for me, because I never let, like, for 15 years, for the first 15 years of my working life, I never let my heart have any say in anything. It was there telling me stuff all along. I was beating that voice down because I was telling myself that it was pointing me in a direction that wasn't, that I wasn't up to. I wasn't up to it. I didn't trust myself. I didn't have the confidence in myself to do what it wanted me to do, what it was suggesting that I could do. So I was kind of fitting in areas that logically made sense. Like some of the jobs that I worked in were, I know that I took them because logically I was saying, like, anyone in the right mind would do this job. Like, you know, like, anyone would accept this job. Why would you not accept this job? And even deep down, I knew it wasn't for me. But that only became clear in hindsight.
Well, my goodness, it sounds like you've been down a very interesting road indeed. And keep going, I'd say to you, keep going. Sounds to me like you're on the right path.
I'm much closer to it than I ever was in the past. Certainly, I definitely am, because I was going in the opposite direction to the direction I wanted to be going in, or that I needed to be going in for a long time. So yeah, I've managed to I've managed to turn the liner and change direction. Tell me about the time that you left RTE, or you left broadcasting. I know you left RTE and you moved to the UK, and then you left broadcasting completely. What, like, was that all instinct and gut and intuition that was leading you, or like did you ever kind of logically think or talk to yourself about why am I giving this up?
Not at all. I trust
because that's amazing. Like, an awful lot of people, because I think a lot of people are in the position right now. They're probably in a job or a relationship that they know is not good, but they feel that they can't take a different path.
Absolutely. And again, you know, it comes up in the talks. I always say to them, if you want to bring change into your life, as I did, if you wait until you can tick all the boxes, you'll never go. For sure, you'll never go. And the objections that would be raised would be, oh, I can't go, I've got a mortgage. And I say, right, that's an obstacle. It's not a solution. The solution is sell the damn thing. Prices are good at the moment. Or somebody else might say, I can't bring change in. I've got kids at school. And I will say, there are good schools in every village in the whole world. Let's talk solutions, not obstacles. So I never thought it through, which is probably just as well for the reason I just said, that if you waited, oh, I can't give up the RT job now because I have to pay my mortgage. What a load of nonsense. I think when you don't think it all through like that, and you don't agonize and you don't obsess, maybe you just have what, you know, the phrase itself, I'm sure, you have a light bulb moment, an aha moment. And I had that moment, and I remember it well to this day, because when you would drive into RTE, which I'd been doing for about 8 years at that stage, you drive in, a little bit of tarmac at them, you hang a right, and you park over there. So it's drive in, little bit of tarmac at them, hang a right, and park over there. Mm. And La Wine, one day, I just said to myself, my God, I'm somewhere in my mid-40s. I'm going to be working for another 20 years. How can I possibly do this? Drive in, little bit of tarmac at them, hang a right, park over there. How can I do that for another 20 years and call it living? That's not living. That's existing. And so I quit.
And did you make that decision very quickly, or did you feel like you were existing for a period of time before you made the decision?
Well, I found, you know, in all the different chapters, we can call it, or phases of my life so far, you start to get the hint at some stage. It's a gradual process. Maybe you don't even notice it much. And then it takes a while for you to extricate yourself. And there seems to be no time limit on that particular period of time where you're trying to get out. Say, for example, if you were working in television, maybe you'd signed a contract to do 34 shows in the year. And when you get your light bulb moment or aha moment, you might only be at 25. So you can't renege. So you have to stick it out for a while. But that doesn't matter either. It's not a problem.
And so let's fast forward there to the point where you decided to leave broadcasting for good, and at that point you felt that it wasn't you said that you felt it wasn't for you, or did you want to, you felt that you couldn't do it for another 20 years, that you would be existing. Did you have something clear in your mind for what you wanted to do next, or was it a case that you just didn't want to do this thing?
It was the latter. I just didn't want to do that thing. But it wasn't just the broadcasting thing, because when I left RTE, I did work with ITV in London and BBC Radio. But I didn't stay very long there either, about 4 years working at it, because I then came to the realization that all I'd really done in terms of change was to change my geography. It was the same job, just a different location. So I got out fairly quickly at that stage. And no, I had no idea what I was going to do next. The only decision I made was, I'm going to sell the house, I'm going to have my freedom, and I'm going on holiday to see if I can clear my head. And I went off innocently and naively again for a 3-week holiday to India. And the 3-week holiday became 15 years.
And did you In that 3 weeks to 15 years, did you go for 3 weeks, come back, or did you go and not come back? Like, what was the practicalities there?
Well, the practicalities were that I'd sold the house, so I was scot free. I'd given up the job, so I went and didn't come back.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there were furniture, bits and pieces, and books and stuff like that in storage, which I left in storage for a year, but it was costing me a fortune. So then I'd come back on holiday and you'd deal with those sort of practicalities of life, get rid of the stuff, start all over again somewhere else. But so, those are only minor issues, really.
Obstacles, as you say, rather than just logistics, right?
Yeah, that's all.
And where, India is a big country, so where did you land there to travel around? Was there a place that you wanted to go to more than any? Where did you go?
Well, I knew exactly where I wanted to go. You see, long before I left Ireland, I developed this fascination and interest in an Indian system of wellness, a holistic system of wellness called Ayurveda. I never talked about it, but I had a huge interest in particular in the psychology of it, how it explains us, how we live and move and have our being, as the Bible would say. And I thought, well, if I'm going on holiday now, I've never been to India before, why don't I go to the place in India where this whole stuff started 5,000 years ago? And that was in the southern state of Kerala. So that's why I was very specific. I chose Kerala. And that's where I lived there afterwards for a long, long time.
What does an Ayurvedic way of living and wellness look like?
I was introduced to it actually by an Irish GP who knew at the time, years ago, an awful lot about different systems of health. And that was where my fascination started from. But he also said this, and I thought it was very, very useful. He said, if you want to live a wellness lifestyle, he said, it doesn't mean that you can't have your glass of wine and your pizza and all of that. But what you must remember to do is to put goodness back into the system every so often. So that's how I live my life. I mean, my system of wellness is, shall we say, sensitively attuned to living a normal life in the Western world and in 2019. Because otherwise, you'd have to be like that fella living up the side of a mountain somewhere, you know, in Donegal, and living off, locusts and wild honey, as John the Baptist apparently did in the Bible. So it's just about remembering to put goodness back in. And it's also very much for me about the mental exercise of de-stressing yourself and getting rid of anxiety and living in the present moment. That would be, for me, the most important aspect of it.
And when you say putting goodness back in, is that in terms of nutrition, of psychological exercises, or everything?
Well, you see, what fascinates me is when you talk to people here in the West about life, they always start with the physical. I had a friend who was ill recently, and I went up then afterwards when he was convalescing to visit him, and I said, how are you? And he gave me the lowdown on every physical ailment. But I said, what about your mind? I was really asking, how is your mind? And people forget to bring that into it here in the Western world. And that's why I like a holistic system of wellness like Ayurveda, because it treats you and me as entities that are constituted of the mind and the body. There's too much emphasis, I think, in the Western world on the physical and not enough on mental health. And that's where I go to every time in my wellness regime. A little bit of calm, a little bit of stilling the mind, no rushing. I will not rush for anybody. And yet I see so many people, I mean, I think effectively killing themselves mentally and physically by having this busy, busy lifestyle. That is not good. That is not healthy. And I won't be part of it.
Yes. And I've heard you speaking about this in the past in terms of what's it all for. And I think that when we actually reflect, and that in itself is a big obstacle for people to reflect and listen to themselves and take a time out effectively. That when we do that, I think it's hard to justify the what's it all for. I think that we're in a lot of cases, and I know because I did it for a long time myself, doing things for the wrong reasons or doing things because I felt I should do them as opposed to doing them because it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, people would ask me when I come back from India, you know, has Ireland changed? And I thought, well, in its core elements, not really, because we always liked a bit of fun. We always had a sense of humor and we can still laugh. So fundamentally in that way, no, still generous, still give a lot of charity, still look after each other, but rushing around too much. Now that I think is a real negative thing. And I noticed also that for many people, it's become almost heroic to be busy. You'll hear people say, oh, I had a great week last week. I was so busy and work was great because it was so busy. And they don't seem to have the realization that as much as it's important to do your job and earn a living and all the rest of it and enjoy it in the process, it's also very important to do nothing. And I actually factor into my diary, if diary it is, a period of time every couple of days for doing nothing. And that, you see, Shane, that's the moment where I still the mind. You cannot still the mind if you're scurrying around like a blue-arsed fly. It simply is impossible. And I think that's the big lesson that a lot of Irish people have to learn, and they better do it soon.
When you said just a couple of things there, on the culture of busyness that I agree that we have, when I live about an hour outside Dublin, I live in County Meath. I don't commute into Dublin every day now. I did it for several years and it wasn't good for my mind or body. Spending 3 hours a day in traffic every day. And so many people do it. And it's like, you know, the traffic is incredibly busy at 6:30 in the morning. Where do you think that the culture of busyness that has developed in Ireland has come from?
I suppose it's, and I'm not a very political person, and I'm certainly not an economist, but I suppose it comes from the whole notion of capitalism, which is about, you know, getting things and making money. And that's the definition of success. And I think it just builds layer upon layer on people. You have to have the bigger house because Mary next door has a bigger house. And then the old car that you have, that's not good enough either. And in order to acquire all these things, you need to make money. And in order to make money, in many cases, you have to work harder and longer. And now, because of the housing problem and the cost of housing, you have to live further out and do the commute. But you know, if only people would realize that is not living, that is only existing. But that's the way it is at the moment. I'm just very, very grateful that I'm not part of it.
It is a real challenge. I think that I'm talking to a guy who's an expert in data analysis. I'm putting together a group of people who are going to be kind of looking at some data, some publicly available data that would not make sense to you or me or most people. But they're going to be looking at that to try and solve some problems or to get some greater intelligence about different things. And one of the things that we might possibly do at some point down the line is have a look in terms of mental health, mental illness, the rate of, say, antidepressant prescriptions in areas where there is a significant commute, and to potentially draw a line through research. Between the daily commute that so many tens or hundreds of thousands of people do every day and their mental well-being, I guess.
Well, my goodness, I've never read anything about that. That would be fascinating. Because I know a couple of people who, for example, live in Longford and commute to Dublin, and I'd say to them, God almighty, would you not move a bit closer? But they love so much the business of coming home to their favorite area that they want to do it that way. But then I say to myself, what's the point? It's a bit like trying to get a hotel room that's affordable in Dublin at the moment, 200 or 300 euros for what you might, you know, spend 6 hours in. And it's the same with commuting from a beautiful part of the country and going to Dublin. By the time you get home, it's nearly time to go to bed. And then because it's a long commute, you have to get up super early. So the only plus point really would be a weekend.
This is it.
Yeah, I'd love to know the results of that study.
Yeah, it's something we're exploring, and I do like I remember I think I first thought about it a few years ago when I was doing that 5 day a week commute, and yeah. I read Giles Brandreth, who I think was he was in the House of Lords in the UK, I think he was, or an MP, but he wrote about he wrote a book about happiness a few years ago, and one of the things that he spoke about, I think it was based on research as well, was that the life expectancy, if you travel, and I'm probably going to get this wrong, but the spirit would be correct, if not maybe the detail, but it was effectively, if you commute more than 90 minutes total per day to work, your life expectancy is 7 years less, was what he had based that on. And effectively he was asking the two questions of, can you live closer to your work? Or can you work closer to where you live? And those two questions might be difficult for a lot of people to answer, but the way he put it was, it's 7 years of your life. It's worth finding an answer to these questions.
Oh my goodness, that's fascinating.
Mm.
I think a lot of people would be shocked by that.
Yeah, it's an interesting one for sure. And I think because Ireland is such a small country, we do commute. We do think that it's okay to commute half the country for work. And it is. You mentioned heroic earlier on. I've heard people, and it's almost when they're talking about it, it's almost a boast in terms of that they're living in Leitrim or in Wexford and working in Dublin.
Yeah,
it's a real challenge, I think.
It is.
The other thing you said there when you were speaking about the scheduling time to do nothing, what does that, like, I think a lot of people are just afraid of doing nothing because we fill that time with distractions, whether it's newspapers or Netflix or movies or whatever. We don't like to spend that time doing nothing. Do you actually physically do nothing?
You're back to physical again, you see.
Yes.
I start with the mental. I mentally do nothing, and also physically. And when I say I mentally do nothing, of course, as anybody will tell you who's done any little bit of meditation at all, the mind is always churning around. The thoughts will come in. And the trick is you just acknowledge them. And then you sort of say, well, fly away now. I'm in no mood for that old shite. That could be a nice mantra, couldn't it? Yeah, so I mentally try to just be, not think. I read somewhere that on average per day, we have 50 to 60,000 thoughts going through our head. I mean, that's an awful factory. That's an awful thought factory. So in my do nothing time, I just try to be in the present moment, keep nice, positive pace about the way my mind is working, and not think about anything that's too serious. And I just sit there. Or I might go out and look at the garden or those sort of nice natural things that you can do. It sounds a bit weird, I suppose, but I do think it's very important in order to aim at least at happiness. And if not happiness, contentment. Mm. And I feel pretty much all of the time I've achieved that. And it's a lovely feeling.
That is a real definition of success. I think I heard Jerry Hussey, he's a performance psychologist, speaking recently, and he gave a definition of success that I took a note of, and he said that success to him is that you've arrived at a place where there's no place you'd rather be.
Yeah, it's the loveliest feeling in the world. Yeah. You know, I'm perfectly happy in the house I'm in. If I had more money, I might do a few different things to it, but I accept that this is the way it is. I love the area that I live in. I have lovely people around me. I love the cool weather of Ireland. And that's another little, you know, life lesson. Why people moan in Ireland about the winter and the rain and all of that sort of thing. And I say, I love the rain. And they say, are you mad? Why do you love the rain? I say, and in a sense now, we're perhaps finishing up where we started. Because we started talking about that little village in southwest Donegal that we both know, Ardra. And I always say to them, if you grow up in southwest Donegal, where it pretty much rains every day, you get to a point in your life where you say to yourself, if I don't learn to love the rain, I'm going to go bloody mad. And so I had to teach myself that. So yeah, I love the weather here too. Not a problem.
My relationship with rain has changed completely after my uncle died after a short but really aggressive cancer illness years ago. And he was somebody who was always, he had his own challenges and difficulties, which he really overcame and was a lesson or an inspiration to us all. Just the way he went about life with joy for the last 10 years of his life. But then he became ill and a really aggressive form of cancer, and he died after about 6 weeks. But I remember spending a night with him. We kind of did a roster or a rota.
Yeah.
A lot of people spent some time with him. So I think I spent two nights with him in St. Vincent's Hospital in Dublin. And I remember, I wasn't with him when he said this, but it was my mother was with him. That there was one day and it was lashing rain. This was in January and this time of year. It was lashing rain, and my mother just remarked on it, as we do, as we tend to do. We remark on the weather. My mother said, "You know, it's lashing rain," and he was lying on a bed that he knew he wasn't going to get out of, I think. Mm. And he said the words, "What I would love to be out in it," and it is something that I think about a lot when it rains. I think of his thoughts on a bed that he wasn't going to see it.
Wasn't that just heartbreaking?
Yeah, it was, and it helped reset, I think, the way we think about things for me as well. Yeah, it was heartbreaking for him. There's no doubt.
Well, I also hope that in telling that story, Shane, that maybe a lot of your listeners will learn from that, because I think that's the most poignant, most heartfelt, and saddest thing that you could think of all day long.
It really
is. And glory to God, we can take life lessons out of sadness, because something else may never happen again. And it's important to remember that every day.
Yes, without a doubt. I'm not going to take up too much more of your time, baby. I really enjoyed talking to you. I want to ask you about your work now. And before I get to that, what was it that brought you? You appear to have found an incredibly inspired and inspiring and relaxed and quiet and still way of living in the time that you spent in India. Why did you leave? Why did you come back home?
Well, this is always the way I describe it. It was that I went to India, as we said earlier, on a holiday. I stayed because I loved what I saw around me. I loved the gentleness of the people. I loved the way that they are kind to each other, how they have a sense of connection, and they made me feel very welcome. And I was in the mood to do something new. And as we also said earlier, there is no logic much in India, in my experience. They live a life that is much more from the heart. And I found that to be a huge challenge when I was setting up a business, and a business that I knew nothing about, which would be hospitality. I ran my own small heritage hotel there. And all of those things were exciting in their challenges. But when you lived there for 15 years, that excitement was gone because it had all now become familiar. And then you're left with the other side of India. As they say in Kerala, every coin has two sides. So there's the exciting and good side, and then there's the not so good side. And that not so good side has got to do with communication, very poor communication skills, no sense of timekeeping at all. And all of those things are important when you're running a hotel, and especially a bit of a posh one, you know, where people are paying you good money to come and stay. So that then becomes a bit of a frustration if you let it. So I thought, I'll get out now before I start to feel any frustration at all. Get out while the going's good. And so I did. And I thought the place to come to was Ireland. I had, in a sense, not had a great sense of home, because although your listeners might think, God, wasn't she the lucky dog, when I say that I lived in a hotel for 10 years. And that sounds grandiose, and it's quite wonderful in many ways. You don't have to lift a finger. Somebody cleans your room, hand washes your laundry, brings you top-notch food, sounds great, but it doesn't create a sense of home. And I was in the mood to recreate a sense of home for me, and I felt that Ireland, my home country, was the place where I would find that. And that has been so.
With all that in mind, you're still a young woman. You still have many years of good health ahead of you. What have you decided to do? What have you invested your time and your energy in since you came back to Ireland? What's your day to day looking like now?
Once again, you know, I have to go back to my old pattern. For me, it's a good pattern. It suits me, and it is that I have no plans, none at all. I'm very happy with what I'm doing on the work front at the moment, which is that I'm giving talks and trying to pass on the life experiences that I've been privileged, really, to have, and all the study that I've done about wellness. So I give the wellness talks around the country and the motivational talks. And also, I sometimes lead wellness tours to India, for example. I'm hired by tour operators to do that. I enjoy that as well. So it's really all about wellness at the moment. And also I give some classes in public speaking, because when I came back, I felt I had to upskill, especially in the digital area. And I went to a lot of seminars, and there I discovered there were many people who knew so much about different aspects of life. They weren't very good at delivering it. And I thought, well, maybe I could get in there and teach a thing or two about public speaking. Because I did once calculate that I presented more than 1,000 live TV shows. And hopefully that's enough practical experience in order to be able to help others. So that's where I'm at the moment. But in typical me fashion, no plans for the future.
Wonderful. And it has served you well. That attitude has served you well. So I think there's a lot to be learned from it.
Well, that's lovely to hear. Thank you.
How can people find out more? It's been wonderful talking to you, Bibi, and I'm really grateful for your time. How can people find out more about Bibi Baskin and what you're up to, and how to find your courses or events or workshops?
Very simple indeed. I have a website, and it's simply called bbbaskin.ie. And it's all there. And you can find me on Twitter, of course. I'm a regular on Twitter. So you can send me a text that way. You'll find me in all of the platforms of social media, actually. Facebook and Instagram and LinkedIn. I'm very easy to find, Shane, if truth be told. Very easy indeed.
Excellent. Bibi, it's been fantastic chatting to you. I wish you the very, very best of luck with everything that you're working on. And I think that your outlook and your mindset on life, on how to live it, is something that a lot of people can benefit from. So thank you very much, Bibi.
Well, absolute pleasure. Thank you very much, Shane, too.